Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Rights Chief Volker Turk has condemned the Taliban's shocking and cruel oppression of Afghan women and girls, which together with a severe humanitarian crisis is jeopardizing the country's entire future. Addressing the Human Rights Council on Tuesday, Mr. Turk said that human rights in Afghanistan were in a state of collapse. He also deplored the devastating precedent set by Afghanistan as the only country in the world where women and girls are denied access to secondary and higher education. Here's Mr. Turk now reacting to the long list of misogynistic restrictions confining the country's women to a life indoors.
What can possibly come next? Any prospect of a stable, prosperous future for Afghanistan rests on the participation of half of the population. Denying women and girls' rights to participate in daily and public life not only denies them their human rights, it denies Afghanistan the benefit of the contributions they have to offer.
The UN World Food Programme, WFP, said that a historic funding shortfall was forcing it to drastically cut rations in most of its operations, potentially pushing an additional 24 million people to the brink of starvation. The funding gap of over 60% is the highest in WFP's history. The UN agency said that massive reductions have already been implemented in almost half of its operations, including hunger hotspots such as Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Haiti, Jordan, Palestine, South Sudan, Somalia, and Syria. WFP's chief economist Arif Hussein highlighted a massive jump in needs which started with the COVID pandemic and was compounded by the war in Ukraine. Some 345 million people in the world already face acute food insecurity. This includes 40 million suffering emergency levels of hunger and at risk of dying from malnutrition. Resources from traditional donors are insufficient, while lower-income countries that are buckling under the burden of their debt struggle to support their populations, Mr. Hussein said. Desperate migrants are increasingly putting their lives at risk while attempting to cross into the United States from Mexico in search of a better life. The latest findings from the UN Migration Agency, IOM, show that 686 migrants died or disappeared on the U.S.-Mexico border in 2022, making it the deadliest land route for migrants worldwide on record. Nearly half of these deaths were linked to the hazardous crossing of the Sonoran and Chihuahuan deserts, IOM said, adding that many more deaths were likely to go unrecorded due to a lack of data from official sources. Other concerning trends recorded in the Americas included a more than 42% increase in deaths on migration routes in the Caribbean last year and the continuing dramatic situation at the Darien Gap. This particularly dangerous jungle border crossing between Panama and Colombia saw 141 documented migrant deaths in 2022. The UN agency revealed that according to its surveys of people who attempted the Darien Gap crossing, 1 in 25 reported that someone they were traveling with had gone missing. IOM stressed that countries needed to act on the data to ensure that safe, regular migration routes are accessible. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
Good afternoon. It is September 13th, 2023, and this is our 4,110th episode of Radio Free Kansas. I'm glad you tuned in today. I am your host, Mike Cadell. Do a little bit of music and, you know, always have our regular Wednesday lineup, which is Radio Eco Shock. Maria Gillardin's Time of Useful Consciousness. It's always informative, her show. Matter of fact, let's see if I can find it. Her promo is right here. And I think, here it is.
The shocking thing is that the hydropower generated often does not go to the people around it. It goes directly into smelters.
Yeah, it goes to aluminum smelters, or it goes to the cities, or it goes to mines. Especially places like Africa sometimes is the most shocking, where you have some of the world's biggest hydro plants, and yet you have very low rates of people with access to electricity.
Patrick McCauley on the impact of large dams and reservoirs. On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
Well, technically, this is part two from last week's, and it's a supplement to a show. That'll be in the second hour. I hope you'll stay tuned and listen to it. I know a lot of you just come here for the headlines news, which we will have here. The most recent, I lucked out and got the most recent Democracy Now. It was released earlier this morning on time, and I'm happy to bring it to you. Here we go.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Libya, rescue efforts continue in the eastern city of Derna following the catastrophic flooding brought about by Storm Daniel's torrential rains, which caused two dams to burst. An estimated 6,000 people have died, though that number is expected to go up. Bodies have been buried in mass graves. In front of Derna's hospital, people are searching for their loved ones amidst the dead bodies lined up on the ground. This is the hospital's manager, Mohammed Al-Kabisi.
The number of dead in this particular section is 1,700 deaths so far. We counted them as they were lying in the hallways. Whoever is identified has been buried. There are some who have not been identified. So we started photographing them and assigning numbers to them, then burying them as well. On the other side, they buried 500 people. Things are very bad. The hospital is dilapidated.
Derna's mayor said the city's dams have not been maintained since 2002. Much of Libya's infrastructure has crumbled during the years-long war and political instability, fueled by U.S. and foreign intervention that's gripped the nation. After headlines, we'll speak with a climate activist in Tripoli. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has ordered three congressional committees to launch an impeachment inquiry into President Biden.
It appears that the president's family has been offered special treatment by Biden's own administration, treatment that not otherwise would have received if they were not related to the president. These are allegations of abuse of power, obstruction, and corruption, and they warrant further investigation by the House of Representatives.
The move came under pressure from far-right Republicans who threatened to remove him as Speaker. House investigations led by Republicans have not produced any evidence that Biden personally benefited from his son Hunter Biden's business deals. McCarthy did not schedule a full House vote on opening the inquiry, as some more moderate Republicans have opposed the action. This all comes as McCarthy's trying to gain his party's support for a deal to keep the government funded beyond a looming September 30th deadline. Florida's far-right lawmaker Matt Gaetz threatened Tuesday to bring a motion that could oust McCarthy over the spending bill, investigations into the Bidens and other issues.
Mr. Speaker, you are out of compliance with the agreement that allowed you to assume this role. The path forward for the House of Representatives is to either bring you into immediate total compliance or remove you pursuant to a motion to vacate the chair.
The White House said the impeachment inquiry was, quote, extreme politics at its worst, while House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries dismissed it as illegitimate and, quote, a kangaroo court, fishing expedition, and conspiracy theater rolled into one. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Russian President Vladimir Putin met earlier today at the Vostochny Cosmodrome in far eastern Russia. Just hours before the leaders met, Pyongyang fired two short-range ballistic missiles off its east coast. Kim spoke as the brief summit opened.
Russia is now in the sacred fight against hegemonic forces in order to protect its sovereignty and security interests. We have constantly expressed our full and unconditional support for all the decisions taken by the president and the Russian leadership, and I want to assure you that we will always be together with Russia in the fight against imperialism.
The details of the Kim-Putin summit are not known, but North Korea and Russia are expected to be in talks over the trade of weapons and military technology. Meanwhile, during a speech at the Eastern Economic Forum in Vladivostok on Tuesday, Putin said Donald Trump's prosecution shows the rottenness of U.S. politics. in Vietnam. Dozens of people are feared dead after a massive fire broke out late Tuesday at a nine-story apartment building in the capital, Hanoi. An official death toll has not been released, but local outlets say at least 30 people were killed, including children, as the blaze was extinguished in the early hours of the morning. More than 50 others were severely injured and taken to hospital. Witnesses who live near the apartment building described hearing residents screaming for help as they tried to flee the building, which reportedly only had one exit. The small apartment balconies were also surrounded by iron bars. One witness said a small boy was thrown out from the building as the flames consumed the complex. Several others reportedly jumped out to escape. In the Philippines, Nobel Peace Prize laureate and journalist Maria Ressa and her website Rappler have been acquitted of their final tax evasion charge. They were acquitted of four other tax evasion charges in January. Maria Ressa had been systematically persecuted for her work by former President Rodrigo Duterte. Ressa still faces three other cases, including a six-year sentence for cyber libel from 2020, which she is now appealing to the Supreme Court. To see our interviews with Maria Ressa, go to democracynow.org. Here in the U.S., new data shows the poverty rate among children more than doubled last year due to record inflation and the expiration of the child tax credit. The pandemic relief helped decrease child poverty rate to a historic low of 5.2% in 2021. That figure surged over 12% after conservative Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and congressional Republicans opposed an extension of the relief. Manchin was the decisive vote. He falsely claimed some low-income parents used the payments to buy drugs when data showed most families used the money to buy food and help with rent. The Debt Collective said on social media, quote, Joe Manchin's legacy includes artificially manufacturing child poverty for no reason other than his callous disregard for human beings, unquote. Overall poverty also increased in 2022 to 12.4%, up from 7.8% in 2021, with more than 37 million U.S. residents living in poverty, the largest single-year jump ever recorded in the U.S. The Center for Reproductive Rights filed lawsuits on behalf of eight patients and four OBGYNs in three states, Idaho, Tennessee, and Oklahoma. The plaintiffs argue abortion bans led to doctors refusing to provide the procedure even in emergency situations over fears of prosecution and other penalties. One of the patients, Nicole Blackman, was forced to carry out her pregnancy after doctors in Tennessee refused to provide an abortion even though there was no chance the fetus would survive. She went on to suffer from preeclampsia, which can be fatal, and delivered a stillborn 7 months into the pregnancy. Nancy Northup, head of the Center for Reproductive Rights, said, quote, no one should have to be at death's door to receive essential health care. But that's exactly what happens when doctors are forced to practice medicine under threat of imprisonment. The women standing up today survived, but it's only a matter of time before someone does not, Northup said. In Tennessee, a federal grand jury indicted five former Memphis police officers for the beating death of Tyree Nichols in January. In addition to state second-degree murder charges, the officers now also face federal civil rights conspiracy and obstruction charges. Video footage shows the men brutally beating, tasing, and pepper-spraying the 29-year-old black father during a traffic stop, which led to his death 3 days later. Tyree Nichols' father, Rodney Wells, spoke Tuesday following the new indictment.
This is a long time coming, and we're so glad that we've reached this point. Mm-hmm. Now, the next milestone is the actual convictions.
Mm-hmm. Amen. That's right. Yeah.
Justice for Tyree.
Justice for Tyree.
Justice for Tyree.
Justice for Tyree.
In Ohio, the family of Takiyah Young is demanding justice weeks after the 21-year-old pregnant mother was shot dead as she was attempting to drive away from a Kroger grocery store parking lot. The police pursued the young black woman after accusing her of shoplifting. Body cam video was released Friday. The family's lawyer, Sean Walton, said, quote, what's clear is that petty theft does not justify murder, and comply or die is not the rule of law in this country. The fact that an unarmed woman was shot unjustifiably, then dragged from her car and handcuffed after being shot, should shock the conscience of everyone, he said. Opening arguments took place in a D.C. courtroom Tuesday in the closely watched antitrust case brought by the federal government in 38 states and territories against Google. They accuse Google of illegally protecting its search engine monopoly by paying billions of dollars to Apple and other smartphone companies and web browsers to be their default search engine. It's the largest antitrust lawsuit brought by the U.S. government against a major tech company since the Justice Department sued Microsoft over 20 years ago. U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta is presiding over the case. He could theoretically order the breakup of Google should the company lose, though analysts say it's more likely Google would be forced to change its business practices. A loss for the government could have implications for its ability to regulate tech and other industry monopolies. The trial is expected to last 10 weeks. In a major victory for climate activists, New York University plans to divest from fossil fuels. Student organizers have been pushing for the divestment for nearly 20 years. The Guardian reported the chair of the NYU Board of Trustees announced a decision in an August letter addressed to Sunrise NYU. The group wrote on social media, quote, "This is a huge win for climate justice. Congratulations to every student organizer who made this happen," they said. And in Washington, D.C., at least 34 indigenous activists were arrested as they rallied in front of the White House calling on President Biden to grant clemency to political prisoner indigenous leader Leonard Peltier. Peltier has maintained his innocence over the 1975 killing of two FBI agents in a shootout on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. His conviction was riddled with irregularities and prosecutorial misconduct. This is indigenous writer, historian Nick Estes, speaking at yesterday's action, which took place on Peltier's 79th birthday.
All Leonard Peltier was fighting for is the future of our people as indigenous people, because they tried to take that away with boarding schools.
Yep.
They tried to erase our children. It's not just about taking them and making them speak English. When you steal youth, you try to steal the future.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report.
Coming up Friday, every Friday.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
Good stuff, really. And they have a tremendous, sense of humor. It's actually sort of fun to listen to them. Tomorrow, Law and Disorder on Thursdays, to remind you of our schedule. We'll have a musical interlude in the beginning of the second hour, but right now, here is Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The UN chief warns climate breakdown has begun. In this show, you hear underreported climate change, Antarctic extreme events, with lead author Martin Siegert from Imperial College London. Plus from Australia, Dr. Martin Eucher on the early start to the ozone hole, what it means, and the Tongan volcano warming the world for years to come. It is Breaking Science from Radio EcoShock. Welcome. As record heat, fires, and storms rock the northern hemisphere, is there anywhere on Earth untouched by climate change? We are going where media does not, to the distant South Pole and the high stratosphere, seeking answers. Scientists thought, we all thought, the great glaciers of Antarctica were outside the climate fray, likely for thousands of years. Even leaders in the field are now changing their views. It turns out the seventh continent, cold home to ice miles thick, is not stable at all. In every aspect, from the deep glaciers through massive ice shelves to the sea ice, it's all been destabilized. As you know, sea ice around Antarctica has plummeted to record low volumes not seen in our times. Even the best glaciologists do not know why. They are convening meetings, conferences, and studies trying to find out. The area of sea ice lost is about the same size as the country of Argentina. Imagine, in a desperate attempt to stall global warming, humans covered up all of Argentina with mirrors to reflect the sun's energy back to space. By the way, massive mirror farms to help balance planet energy is a real thing. The Mirror Project, spelled M-E-E-R, is working it out. In our December 2020 show, Brent Ragsdale interviewed scientist and engineer Yi Tao from Harvard about the mirror geoengineering idea. So in our imaginary mirror covering Argentina, there is an unexplained breakdown. The surface on all the mirrors degrades, leaving a dark base that absorbs solar energy instead. The giant mirrors break down, and Earth absorbs more heat instead of cooling us. What an accident, what a tragedy, and that is exactly what just happened in recent years around Antarctica. Vast fields of bright white ice, acting as solar reflectors, melted away to reveal a dark ocean surface below. Not reported much in the media and unknown to the general public, we just went through a kind of geophysical change around the South Pole that adds energy greater than a million nuclear explosions to the world's ocean every day, every year. The big loss of sea ice around Antarctica is just another factor heating the world's oceans, destabilizing weather, stoking rapid intense hurricane buildup or typhoons, and pushing heat waves onto the land. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get the straight news from top scientists here on Radio EcoShock.
A clear lesson from the geological record is one of dynamism, which reveals that the Antarctic ice sheet is not a static giant frozen in time, but rather that it responds sporadically and unpredictably to large-scale environmental change. A lesson we should learn as Antarctica's environment is changed further because of fossil fuel burning.
Extreme weather events are reported all over the world. Can they hit Antarctica as well? Did you know the biggest recorded heat wave, as a sudden rise in temperature, happened near the South Pole? How fragile is Antarctica? We have first answers in a new paper titled Antarctic Extreme Events. The lead author is Dr. Martin Siegert, professor at Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Imperial College London. He is a glaciologist and world-recognized Antarctic scholar. From the UK, Martin Siegert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure to be here.
Even a dozen years ago, Martin, many ice experts discounted most of Antarctica from any serious change in the next 1,000 years. Now we have to toss out those old assumptions?
Yeah, I think I'd probably count myself among those glaciologists that maybe if by 2010 we were thinking that the Antarctic ice sheet was this amazing place full of interesting things to discover, of course, fascinating from the perspective of it being a region isolated from the rest of the planet, captured in time, sort of unchanged, largely for at least 14 million years. And that was the sort of evidence that we were coming to terms with from what we could gather. But of course, that's not the case now. We've learned from the geological record, but also from events that are happening right now, right in front of us, that in fact Antarctica is subject to a lot of change, a lot of extreme things occur in Antarctica that we've been surprised about. And unfortunately, some of those things are very much linked to wider global heating issues relating to the burning of fossil fuels.
I know this summer European cities went from cold to punishing heat, and then some streets turned to instant rivers in record rain. Can such rapid changes happen in the cold house we find at the Southern Pole?
Yeah, well, they have been. Of course, we've become accustomed to, sadly, to extreme events, and we've seen those all over the world. There doesn't seem to be any place that humans inhabit that isn't subject to extreme weather conditions one way or another, and that can manifest as droughts, it can manifest as extreme heating conditions, and that can lead to wildfires. We've seen extreme flooding events, often over areas of land that are already dry, and so you get huge flash flooding that occurs as a result. And all those things, sadly, contribute to the loss of livelihoods, and very sadly, to the loss of lives. And it doesn't really matter if you're in the developed countries or a country that has got a fully developed and rich economy, this is still affecting people's lives and livelihoods, and we should be very concerned about it. The question we put to ourselves was, is Antarctica subject to extreme events as well? And the most obvious extreme events are weather events, not alone weather events. There are other events that occur in Antarctica that we'd like to capture in our understanding of extreme things that happen in Antarctica. But, of course, the world's largest ever heat wave happened in March in 2022, where the temperatures in East Antarctica, that should have been something like minus 50 degrees centigrade, turned out to be more like minus 10 degrees centigrade. It's a jump above the norm of about 38 degrees centigrade, which is utterly unheard of. We've had some very hot weather in Europe this year, and, of course, last year in London, for the first time ever, and in many other parts of the United Kingdom, the temperature rose above 40 degrees centigrade. Now that will be a shift from the normal midsummer of about 17 degrees, usually about 23 degrees. So getting to 40 is about 17 degrees. Well, you know, 38 degrees temperature shift in Antarctica is phenomenal. If we'd have had something like that in London, it would have been 60 degrees centigrade, which, of course, would have been colossal. So yes, Antarctica is subject to extreme conditions. These are things that we hadn't noticed before, not because we hadn't been looking, but because they hadn't been occurring. And so we're deeply concerned about that. There are some other things which are not necessarily weather-induced, but are definitely global heating-induced, and that is, right at this moment, the extreme loss of Antarctic sea ice that should be growing around this time of year. It's winter in Antarctica, and throughout this winter in Antarctica, the sea ice in many places just hasn't been forming in ways which we've never seen before, the lowest ever recorded sea ice growth phase in Antarctica, with potentially significant consequences for the rest of the planet.
What are some of those consequences? Why does it matter if the sea ice plunges around Antarctica? I mean, it doesn't directly add to sea level rise.
Absolutely. It contributes nothing directly to sea level. But there are a couple of things we are deeply concerned about, one of which does relate to sea level, which I'll come on to. But the first, if we look at the Arctic in the north, the sea ice there has been retreating fairly steadily since the 1970s. And what we've recorded in the Arctic is this replacement of a very bright reflecting surface, which is the snow and ice, by a very dark absorbing surface. So ordinarily, snow and ice, the solar radiation that beams down on it gets reflected back out into space. And so the Earth does not heat up as a consequence of having that snow and ice on its surface. But if it's not there anymore and it's replaced by dark ocean or dark land, then the sun's radiation gets absorbed by the ocean or by the land, and further heating results. We've seen that in the Arctic, and which is why the Arctic region is warming at around about four times the rate of the rest of the planet. So the Arctic is no longer acting to cool the planet. It's actually doing the reverse. It's accelerating warming on our planet. But the Antarctic hasn't been like that traditionally. So up until 2017, we've actually been seeing Antarctic sea ice grow, which has done us a wonderful sort of ecosystem favor by bouncing all that solar radiation back out into space. But since 2017, year on year, we've seen less and less sea ice. And what we're very concerned about is that the Antarctic is now starting to behave much like the Arctic has done for the last 30, 40, 50 years. And that is, we start losing the ice. The loss of ice leads to further warming because of the absorption of solar radiation, and that leads in turn to even less ice and so on. So there's a feedback process that results. If through time, so the next 10, 20 or so years, Antarctica really starts behaving like the Arctic and starts contributing to accelerated global warming, then neither of the polar regions will be acting in our favor to cool the planet, and both will be trying to heat it, and that's why there'll be an acceleration in global warming as a consequence of that process. So we're very concerned about that. The additional reason we're concerned is because of the knock-on consequence of heating in the Antarctic to the sustainability and survival of the massive slabs of ice which are floating around Antarctica that are formed by the grounded ice, the ice sheets. And those massive slabs of ice are called ice shelves. They act to essentially hold back the grounded ice from flowing into the ocean. Now, we know that some of these ice shelves have broken up catastrophically in the past, But there are many ice shelves around Antarctica that haven't yet disintegrated. But if they did, then we would see an acceleration of grounded ice flow from the continent into the ocean. You see, you don't need to melt the ice to cause sea level rise. All you need to do is to push it into the ocean. And under Archimedes' principle, it displaces its own weight in water, and the sea level goes up. You know, it can take 1,000 years to melt a big iceberg. It doesn't matter. Sea level has already happened instantly by virtue of it being in the water. So how does an ice shelf become unstable? Well, it can do that if the temperature, the ocean, and the atmospheric temperature around it starts to warm up. So losing Antarctic sea ice is bad for the planet in terms of accelerated global warming, but it could be really bad for the planet in terms of activating the Antarctic ice sheet to contribute much more to global sea level rise than it has done historically.
Well, speaking of feedback loops, strangely, one of the new worries addressed in your new paper is the impact of more land appearing as ice retreats. We would have thought that would be a good thing. How could that affect warming?
Well, for exactly the same reason. So if the land is covered by snow, then what will happen is that the solar radiation will be bounced back off it. But if that is exposing rock and soil, then that will heat up. The other reason that it's a concern is because of the occurrence of invasive alien species, so plants and maybe even insects in some parts of the northern part of the Antarctic Peninsula, being able to colonize that exposed land in ways that haven't been possible traditionally. And what we're really concerned about is some alien species being able to colonize the area much more quickly than a native species, simply by virtue of the native species not being particularly good at surviving warm conditions. And if you warm the Antarctic Peninsula up, it might be better suited to plants that at the moment don't normally survive in those regions. So that's another sort of ecological biodiversity issue.
A recent EcoShock guest explained part of Greenland was last exposed to sunlight around 400,000 years ago. When was the last time Antarctica had significant melting and ice loss?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So, you know, if you were asked me this question maybe 25, 30 years ago, there were two schools of thought, and they were completely opposing schools of thought. And there was a big debate in the scientific literature. One postulated that just 3 million years ago, in a period called the Pliocene, pretty much the whole of the ice was lost. It was all gone. And there was another side that said, oh, no, the Antarctic ice sheet has largely been unchanged for about the last at least 14 million years. And there was sort of evidence on both sides of this argument, probably more for the latter than the former, I should say. But there was some evidence for all of that. What we're beginning to learn now as we appreciate the dynamism of the Antarctic ice sheet is that you don't need to collapse the whole ice sheet to answer some of the questions that sort of former hypothesis had. And at the same time, it's just not right to consider Antarctica not changing at all, when it stands to reason that if the world's temperature changes, so would the Antarctic ice sheet. And what we've come to appreciate, and it's fairly settled now in the scientific literature, is that in the Pliocene, 3 million years ago, the Antarctic ice sheet in places was less big than it is at the moment, but was still there, persistent in some places, in many places. But the loss of Antarctic ice in the Pliocene 3 or so million years ago led to, occasionally, the sea level then being over 20 meters higher than it is today. And that's the enormous thing about the Antarctic ice sheet that we must be aware of. And, you know, I studied Antarctic ice sheet because it's very interesting scientifically. But there's an important reason why society needs to understand it as well. And that is because it's a colossal store of water, ice, that currently lies above the level of the ocean. And as it melts and as it moves into the ocean, we will start to see global sea level rise. You know, there are 300,000 glaciers all around the planet, right, apart from Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheet. And if all those glaciers melted, but Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet didn't melt, then the global sea level that would occur would be somewhere between 25 to 30 centimeters. That's all it would be, which is bad, right, but that's all it would be. There's enough ice held in the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheet to raise sea level by over 60 meters. That'd be terrible, of course, and it would take thousands of years to do. But actually, you don't need 60 meters to cause us, our society, a problem. 1 meter will be really bad news. 5 meters will be a tragedy for many low-lying Pacific nations and ports and cities and things. And I've got to tell you that under a high level of warming, it is possible for the ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, to respond in this accelerated way, such that by this century, we could have 1.5 meters, maybe 2 meters of sea level rise, and by the middle of next century, 3 to 5 meters of sea level rise. And that's if we don't stop burning fossil fuels. So we can do something about that now, take us away from a sort of strong warming future and save ourselves from this colossal problem. But if we don't do it, then we're stacking up problems for our children and those that come afterwards, because once these ice sheets start to become dynamic, once they start to flow into the ocean, once they start to melt, there will be very little we can do to stop it.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Antarctic expert and Professor Martin Siegert. Your extreme study for Antarctica, it's not just about ice. Tell us about the perils you found encountered by living things in a changing Antarctica.
Yes, indeed. So we can talk about the sea ice as well. So sea ice is a very important substance for marine mammals, so seals and penguins and things. And if the sea ice starts to retreat, then the habitat in which those animals can survive becomes less and less. So that's a bad thing. We can talk about as it starts to rain in Antarctica, and unfortunately, you know, 30 years ago, you would never be talking about raining in Antarctica, but it can happen now. And for chicks, penguin chicks, they've been evolved to never experience rain events, and their feathers just aren't equipped to be able to do it. So they survive with these fluffy feathers for pretty cold conditions, but dry conditions. And unfortunately, as it starts to rain, these chicks get wet. And if a cold event happens while they're still wet, then that wetness turns to ice, and these chicks will perish. And we're starting to see the loss of tens of thousands of penguin chicks as a consequence of rain events and warming, and as a consequence of the reduction in sea ice. So that's a deep concern. But, you know, it's nothing new. So that's a global warming issue and a burning of fossil fuels issue. But we can look back 100 or so years to another oil boom, and that wasn't oil and gas from the ground, but it was oil extracted from whales. And we virtually hunted humpback whales and blue whales to near extinction simply to try to get the oil from them. So humans and our fixation, we're completely hooked like a drug on oil, on fossil fuels now, but oil. And it's caused us to do awful things to our planet. Firstly, with the near extinction of very large marine mammals, northern whales, and more recently, the huge ecological and climate damage that we're doing at the moment. And we know if we stop whaling, as we stop whaling, those whale numbers came back, and that's great. It took a lot of time for that to happen. But it does tell us that once we stop and mend our ways and think about living on our planet in a sustainable way, things can be repaired, and that's what we're hoping with the climate problem as well.
Looking at new mechanisms in Greenland, we find the role of sudden ponds, torrents of water running deep into the glaciers, unexpected fragility to that whole massive ice structure. Do you see similar large-scale threats in ice stability in Antarctica?
Yeah, so we haven't at the moment. So in Greenland, you get these enormous ponds of water on the surface, and they find themselves through holes in the ice, and they get down to the bed of the ice sheet, and it can cause the base of the ice to become lubricated and to flow more quickly. And so that's been known about for some time. Quite a lot of research has been done on that. We've never seen that happen in Antarctica, but what we are starting to see is the ponding of water, much more than we had done some decades ago. And so the first element of Antarctica to becoming a little bit more like Greenland, we're starting to see that with the ponding of water. Of course, ice shelf disintegration, the floating slabs of ice that break up, can break up really quickly. That happens as a consequence of this process, and we've known that, and we've seen it on a number of ice shelves, large and small, all around the Antarctic continent, because of ponded water and that water finding its way down through the slab of ice to the water underneath. And once a hole gets punctured into the ice shelf, then the sort of structural integrity of the ice gets compromised. And as it happens repeatedly, then the whole ice shelf becomes useless as a way of maintaining itself and just breaks up catastrophically. So that's the process that we've known about. We can see it happening in some ice shelves, and there's been examples of it. And we're deeply concerned as more ice shelves get exposed to surface melting, that this can happen elsewhere in Antarctica.
One of the most frightening recent interviews on this program was about changes to ocean currents in the Southern Ocean and especially around Antarctica. That was with Dr. Matthew England. Was ocean change included in your study?
Yes, it was. We've seen marine heat waves happen in Antarctica. The problem with working in the ocean in Antarctica is a problem of data sparsity. You know, we just don't have an awful lot of measurements and observations. The Southern Ocean is vast. And we have some measurements, but nowhere near enough. There was a very good international arrangement of Southern Ocean observations, and that's fantastic, but we need an awful lot more. But we have had recorded evidence of multiple marine heat waves in Antarctica. Unlike the Arctic, the Antarctic Ocean, the Southern Ocean, is very mixed. It's very dynamic, and it's quite complicated to understand in a predictive kind of way. The Arctic is much more simple. You know, it's a pretty static ocean. There's not a lot of connection with it and the rest of the planet. But the Southern Ocean is very well coupled to ocean water elsewhere. And that's important because as the Southern Ocean changes, it can have an influence on the flow of water around the world, which is why as Antarctica changes, it impacts the Southern Ocean, and the impact of the Southern Ocean on ocean flows elsewhere will cause, of course, the transfer of heat around our planet to be changed, as Matt England would have told you about in your previous conversation.
Also on this program, Dr. Tim Lenton warned of cascading tipping points that could shift world climate in unexpected ways. What do we know about Antarctic tipping points, their proximity, and potential risks?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I've had quite a few conversations with Tim and others about what we're seeing in Antarctica and whether those are actually tipping points, i.e. moving to a completely new state, or whether they are just positive feedbacks that we're starting to see. I mean, the positive feedback not being in a good sense, the positive feedback being in an accelerated, amplified sense. We are definitely seeing those. I'm not sure that we're quite ready to talk about Antarctica being tipped into a new regime quite yet.
And what did you and your 13 co-authors find as extreme interactions between the polar atmosphere and the ice?
Well, of course, an obvious one is a lack of ozone that we've known about for some time, and hopefully the repairing of that, the cover through carbons that were plentiful and used all the time in refrigeration systems. There was a ready, cheap replacement for those, and so the Madrid Protocol that banned the use of CFCs was so well received and effective because there was a ready alternative to it. So it just shows you what can be done if that alternative can be found. But of course, what we're seeing from an atmospheric sense is much more dynamism. And that heat wave that we were referring to earlier, 38 degrees, was a phenomenal event that happened in Antarctica. Usually what happens with weather systems is they wrap around clockwise around Antarctica by virtue of the polar vortex, very high atmospheric river of fast flowing air, and also the orography of the continent. It's the highest continent by quite a long way on the planet, just because of the massive ice sheet that is, you know, in some places above 4 kilometers above sea level, and in many places above 2.5 kilometers above sea level. This kind of stops these storms from coming in. But what happened in March into 2022 was phenomenal. This jet, this river of atmospheric flows, essentially from Australia, ripping through and across the Southern Ocean and onto the Antarctic continent in ways we've just never seen before. And it was that very warm, moist air that caused the heat wave. And we're still trying to understand how that was possible, whether that was truly a complete freak, or because we're starting to see extreme events and in all realms in Antarctica right now, whether that too was associated with the burning of fossil fuels. And I think it's probably fair to argue at this stage that the fingers are pointing at global heating and the enhanced dynamism in our atmosphere as a consequence of that, which probably caused that heat event. In fact, there's a paper that's come out very recently that attributes that extreme event to the burning of fossil fuels.
Given the latest reports of fragile states at both poles, the 1 meter sea level rise by 2100 estimated by the IPCC sounds very low, very optimistic. If there is more, the risk to coastal cities and agricultural deltas could be catastrophic. After your review, what do you think?
Yeah, so in 2020, I and some colleagues wrote a paper about potential sea level rise in a preemptive investigation because we were aware that the IPCC report was essentially saying those things at about a meter, maximum of a meter by the century. Well, that is what is regarded as being an unlikely outcome, and that's likely in terms of the ice sheet response to global warming, but also the likely global warming that will result under different scenarios. And what we were very concerned about was what would happen to Greenland and Antarctica under extreme global warming, which, by the way, is the sort of track that we're on at the moment. And when you look at those extreme conditions, it turns out that the confidence that we have in sea level rise being about a meter by 2100 is around about 66%. Well, that means there's a 1 in 3 chance of it being outside of that range, and there's virtually no chance of it being less than like half a meter. So the 1 in 3 chance will be higher than 1 meter, and we wanted to point that out to everybody because it might seem unlikely, but you can't discount it from happening, especially under a strong warming future, which, as I said, is like the track that we're on at the moment. Whether you believe or whether you want to understand that and accept it or not doesn't actually matter too much, because 2100 is just an arbitrary time. So we're worried about sea level rise, not necessarily just at 2100, because that's a bit of an arbitrary number. What we're worried about is the trajectory of sea level rise and where it's going. And in all scenarios, it keeps going up into next century and beyond. So it is possible for there to be at least 1 meter of sea level rise this century. It could be more. But by 2150, say, it'll be further sea level rise and maybe somewhere between 3 to 5 meters. And it keeps going after that. The problem is this is a direct consequence of burning fossil fuels. And we are activating, mobilizing the Antarctic ice sheet and indeed the Greenland ice sheet to respond in this way. Once we activate it, once we provoke Antarctica and Greenland to start losing ice, it will be very difficult to stop it again. And so we are causing now massive problems for our future, for our children's future, and for many generations that come after them. We are behaving in a very irresponsible way for the future of our planet, and we're doing it knowingly and willingly. And we really must stop that, because we want to live on this planet in a healthy, happy way that allows us to fulfill our ambitions. But also we want our children and those that come after to be able to have the same privilege. And we're disallowing them from doing that right now because of the actions we're taking.
Yes, the study points again and again to fundamental questions we need answered, not about other planets, but one of the seven great continents on this one. Martin Siegert, what would you tell governments, and what are you working on next?
Yes, so there are many things about Antarctica that's fascinating and we want to do. So one thing I really want to achieve for the benefit of climate science and our ability to predict sea level rise much better than we are at the moment is a systematic geophysical survey of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets. You might imagine that we would have done that already. You know, we've systematically mapped the surface of Mars, for example, but we've never done that to the Antarctic ice sheet base. But that information is fundamental to models of ice sheet flow and therefore for prediction of global sea level. So it is something that is missing. We have a rudimentary understanding of what's underneath the ice, but not in an optimized way, optimized for the use of modeling. And so we urgently need that, and me and quite a few other people are starting to contemplate how we go about providing that survey and offering it to everybody, because it's urgently needed for future generations to understand how sea level is going to go up. But when I was speaking to decision makers and politicians, well, I stopped talking about global heating, because it feels when you do that global warming and global heating is the cause. It isn't. The cause is burning fossil fuels, and we absolutely must transition to net zero as quickly as we possibly can by mid-century in the next 30 years. And then that gives us a chance. It gives us a chance to restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees, so that's another 0.3 degrees above where we are at the moment, and to maintaining the sanctity, the preservation of the Antarctic continent and the Greenland ice sheet, of course, in some way. Because if we don't do those things, then those ice sheets are lost, and for many generations after us, they'll feel the consequences.
From the Grantham Institute for Climate Change and Imperial College London, we've been speaking with Professor Martin Siegert. You can find links to the new paper, Antarctic Extreme Events. It's free access. It's in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Martin Siegert, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The Guardian headline reads, "Fears over Antarctic sea ice as yearly ozone hole forms very early." And what does all this talk about solar storms and climate change? Only a unique scientist could explain all that, and we have reached him. Dr. Martin Eucher trained in plasma physics in Switzerland, but now he lectures at the Climate Change Research Center, University of New South Wales in Australia. Martin also serves as associate investigator at the ARC Center for Excellence for Climate Extremes in Australia. He can be our doorway into these frontiers of science. From Sydney, Australia, Martin Eucher, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, just as an introduction, your original field, what is plasma physics?
Oh, that was all about generating energy with nuclear fusion rather than fission. To do that, you need a so-called plasma, which is a fourth state of matter, which is after gas. You heat even more. You start separate electrons and ions from the atoms, and that creates a plasma. So it's got nothing to do with the medical plasma, which you might have in mind when you hear the word plasma.
Right. Why are you now publishing climate-related research?
Oh, I've been working in climate for 12 years now, and that was just after my thesis, PhD thesis in plasma physics. I was just ready for another subject. I wanted to explore something else, and it turns out that in physical terms, atmospheric dynamics is, in a way, an application of fluid dynamics, and so is plasma physics. So the two fields aren't that different.
So let's get to that Guardian headline. What is the news about the ozone hole this year, Martin?
Yeah, so the ozone hole formed rather early. It's not the earliest in history, but it was quite early in particular because we're all hoping that this ozone hole is closing slowly. And so, it opened up early, and it developed into quite, you know, much bigger than it normally was in August. And since then, it came back a little for a few days, and then it's gone up again, and currently it's not the largest we've ever seen, but it is the largest from, you know, the last 2 years, certainly. So it's just pretty large, and we expect it to grow more because it usually peaks around October, maybe November. So it's going to grow more.
So this dangerous state of affairs in the upper atmosphere has not gone away. How could changes in the ozone hole affect sea ice formation around Antarctica?
Yeah, so, well, but the ozone itself, when it's there in the stratosphere, does is that it blocks solar radiation, and in particular why it's been so much concern for us humans is that it blocks ultraviolet radiation, which is very energetic and which is, of course, a health concern for us if that radiation reaches the surface. So normally that ozone is there and removes all of that radiation because in the chemical cycle of ozone, its life cycle, if you like, it consumes this radiation, it absorbs it. And when that ozone is not there, it reaches the surface. And so the link to sea ice, it is not a very clear link there. But what's happening is that all of this energy that now does hit the surface, and in particular the ozone hole is strongest over the pole and close to Antarctica. So all of that energy would hit not the ice, but the ocean water around the sea ice, or in which the sea ice, the icebergs are floating, and as it could heat up the water, which then would melt more ice.
And this ozone hole is developing now, which in the southern hemisphere would be almost the beginning of spring, so that it's going to be fairly large when the sun is there, really there, almost 24 hours a day at some point.
Yes, no, that's correct. So by December, it will probably still be there, although then through more of the summer, our summer, as in January, February, the ozone hole disappears because there's different mechanisms. There's ozone being transported from elsewhere over where the ozone hole used to be. And one thing about the ozone hole is that in order to develop, it needs very low temperatures. And in summer, even up in the stratosphere, it's actually too warm. And so the hole closes again, and then it can open again the year after. But really the concern is this month of, well, end of November and December, when, of course, December is the solstice. So, yes, that's when the sun is strongest.
Now, you talk and work with other scientists, including Matthew England. What are people thinking is driving this sudden decline of Antarctic sea ice?
So there's a lot of people working on this. There are also, here in Australia, there's centers where many, many different scientists come together and work specifically on Antarctic science. So it's a big focus where a lot of people work on why currently the sea ice is so low. I guess the main reason is that the sea temperatures, so the oceans, are so warm. And I'm sure everybody's seen those plots as well, with this year just being way off what any other year was. And, of course, warm water melts the ice. You know that from your cocktail, right? You put ice in and you don't drink it immediately. The ice goes away. Well, the main concern is really the warm waters. And why this year they are so high is actually a good question. I don't think anybody really knows why this year it's so much warmer than the previous year, for example.
That is what I'm hearing from other scientists. Many are surprised and puzzled, and I'm sure there's a lot of analysis going on trying to find that out. Now, I want to talk for a little minute about the stratosphere and the troposphere. These are the two sort of layers that we designate in the atmosphere. And generally, there's a careful distinction between the two. And we've been told, well, weather happens in the troposphere, which is nearest to the surface here, but not really in the stratosphere. They operate on almost different rules. But are scientists discovering interaction, more interaction than we thought, between these two layers of the atmosphere?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's all correct. So the big difference is really that what the temperature does as you go up into higher altitude. We all know that if you go up, if we hike up a mountain, or if you look at the temperature display in an airplane, the higher we go, the colder it gets. That's in the troposphere. But the distinction is made in the stratosphere is that the higher it gets, it actually gets warmer again. And that is exactly due to the ozone, which absorbs radiation and therefore warms up. And there's more ozone as you go higher up. And so that makes a big difference, because it means that in the troposphere, where it gets colder, you may know that warmer objects or warmer fluid, a warmer air or warmer water, is lighter than colder air or water. And so when it's warmer, it floats up. It's like a bubble in your lemonade. It floats up, and it's warmer than the surroundings, so it floats up even more, because when it gets higher, all its surroundings is getting cooler and cooler. And so that creates thunderstorms, for instance, and that creates what we call the weather in the troposphere. But in the stratosphere, if something rises, it's going to be cooler than its surroundings all the time, because as it rises, the surrounding is warmer, and so it will sink back down because it's heavier than all its surroundings. So that's the big difference with the stratosphere. There is no thunderstorms, none of those thick clouds, no rain in the stratosphere because of that. And now, yes, you've mentioned, we discover more and more that these two layers, they used to be thought of as distinct because the processes that are happening are so different. But we now find that there's a lot of interaction between how strong the winds are in the stratosphere, and that has implications how our surface weather behaves.
In 2021, you co-authored a paper about sudden stratospheric warming events in Antarctica. What are they, and can they affect ice melt or sea ice formation or anything lower down?
Yes. So sudden stratospheric warmings are exactly when the winds in the stratosphere, usually in the winter in the stratosphere, there are very strong winds, and we call this the polar vortex. That's up in the stratosphere. And when these winds, for various reasons, they can suddenly become much weaker, or they can even reverse direction. And that's a sudden, we call this a sudden warming, because this is always also accompanied with the temperature getting warmer. The winds get weaker, the temperatures get warmer. But that's only in the stratosphere. But it turns out that these events have strong impacts at the surface. And that's in both hemispheres. When the winds in the stratosphere in the winter get weaker, usually that means that the jet stream in the troposphere, so the strong winds which we also have in the troposphere, they shift towards the equator. And that would mean more cold snap, for instance, for continental America, or so the U.S., Canada, North America, that would mean we have a higher risk of cold snaps because the polar air can now come further southward than usual. And so in the southern hemisphere, the same thing happens. It's just that there's not so many continents and not so many people living where the most of the effect is. But we have the same shift. We have the same expansion of polar air towards the equator, and that has implications on sea ice as well, because it means that the winds are different, so the sea ice, the floating sea ice, is being blown into different directions, but it's also generally colder, so there will be less melting or even an expansion of sea ice when these events happen.
And yet that 2021 paper concludes there will be far fewer appearances of sudden stratospheric warming in Antarctica as the planet warms. They may be hundreds of years apart instead of 1 in 22 years, just as an example. So sudden stratospheric warming may not matter much anymore, at least at the South Pole.
Yes. So one caveat to that result is that what we used in that study is the same definition for Antarctica as we normally use for the North Pole, so for the Arctic. But there exist events, so these warmings, which are, and those are based on very strong events, because they happen often enough in the Northern Hemisphere that we can concentrate only on the strongest of these events. But in the Southern Hemisphere, so what our paper showed was similarly strong events are basically a thing of the past. They're not going to happen anymore. But what different research from different groups around the world has shown is that in the Southern Hemisphere, we don't need such strong events to still have a surface impact. So we are now actually currently working on looking at how could we redefine these sudden warmings to detect events which still have an impact, but might actually, which we should expect to still happen in the future.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is scientist Dr. Martin Eucher from the University of New South Wales, Australia. Well, during the 2011 Fukushima nuclear power disaster, a camera caught Reactor 3 explode, and it blasted radioactive materials into the stratosphere, and that turned out to be very important. We learned radioactivity would stay up a longer time and fall back all over the Northern Hemisphere. So the key to a local event going global is reaching the stratosphere. And why is that, and how does that apply to that Tongan volcano eruption in January of 2022?
Yes, so what's important here is what I described as the difference between the stratosphere and the troposphere is that there's no weather, no storms, no rain in the stratosphere. So anything that gets blown into the troposphere, so the air close to the surface but stays there, will rather quickly be part of a storm, be in a cloud, and then be actually rained out. And it will, in such a way, will be removed rather quickly from the air because it will just fall down together with raindrops, or the strong winds will blow it somewhere else, and then it finally will end up in some rain event. But when it reaches the stratosphere, there is no rain, there is no thunderstorms, and so those particles, they're pretty light, so they're getting just, they can float for a long time, and if the winds are strong enough, which is the case in the stratosphere, they're getting distributed all over the globe, just as you mentioned before. And then they will slowly, slowly, again, because they're so light, they will eventually fall down due to gravity, but that will take a long time because they're so light and small, and there's no raindrops which would drag them down. And the same thing happened with the Hunga Tonga eruption in January 2022, when a lot of not radioactive material this time, but water vapor was injected into the stratosphere. That water came from the ocean water above the volcano, because the volcano erupted underwater. That was just evaporating all the water. It was just steam, an enormous cloud of hot steam which reached the stratosphere. And that water is still in the stratosphere, and we expect it to impact surface climate for 7 to 8 years.
Well, it's so weird because we expect volcanic eruptions to cool the planet a little, but now this eruption is considered a warming influence by some.
So this volcano is very special because in a normal volcano you would have lots of smoke as well, and you would have sulfur in particular. You would smell of rotten eggs. And that smoke and sulfur, that actually acts to reflect solar radiation when it's in the atmosphere. And so you would have a cooling effect. But now this volcano had almost no sulfur or no smoke because it was an underwater volcano. And in turn, it had a lot of water vapor. And now water vapor is the strongest greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. And this is why we could expect or might expect a warming at the surface due to this volcano rather than a cooling, simply because what's been injected into, blown into the stratosphere is a greenhouse gas.
Well, let's peek into another of your new co-authored papers, and here we learn that there are, in fact, maybe they're light, but there are some clouds in the stratosphere. Published March 13, 2023, the title is Can Polar Stratospheric Clouds Explain Arctic Amplification? And I tuned right in when you suggested connections between increasing methane in the atmosphere, and it certainly is increasing, to very high polar clouds, and then that somehow feeds back to extra warming in the Arctic. Could you please draw us that map of how that works?
Yes. So while there is no rain in the stratosphere, it is true that in the winter over the pole, there are clouds forming, but these are not clouds that we see. They are so thin that even if they're there and we look up at the sky, we don't see them. And they're formed from ice particles. So the fact that they're thin that we can't see them means that sunlight can just go through them. It doesn't interact anything. It isn't reflected or anything. But what happens is that these ice particles of those polar stratospheric clouds, they do interact with long-wave radiation which comes back from the surface. And so they do block the radiation that comes back from the surface due to the temperature of the surface. It blocks that, and that's exactly the greenhouse effect. So that's exactly the same thing with carbon dioxide, with water vapor, but this time with these ice crystals from those polar stratospheric clouds. So they can, and that's been known for a while, they can have effect, but so far we thought that that effect is so small that we don't have to care about it because there's not many of those clouds and they're only there in winter. And so what our research was trying to explore was, well, in particular in past climates, so very long time ago, we don't know how much methane there was in the atmosphere, but we think it was a lot more than was now. And so we ran a climate model which can deal with the chemistry and the clouds and radiation, and increased methane within the range that we think it could have been. And we found that if there's enough methane, we suddenly start producing a lot more of these polar stratospheric clouds, and therefore we have a larger greenhouse effect of these clouds, and that could contribute to polar amplification.
Okay, now I want to just jag over to another thing here, and I don't know whether you have an answer to this or not, but let's give it a shot. A listener sent me an article written by two Norwegian scientists, and among other concerns, they warn that solar storms causes the ionosphere to precipitate electrons, which then fall as electron precipitation, or EEP, and that increases nitrogen dioxide, damaging the ozone layer, they say. So we are reaching the peak of the sun's 11-year cycle. Martin, you have expertise on this. Do you think changes in solar activity are a factor in this year's ozone hole, or even in the extreme heat that's popping up around the world?
So, yeah, it is not my center of expertise, but I do not think that this, I think it's a question of order of magnitude. I'm certain that solar storms interact with the Earth's ionosphere. This is the whole reason why we see Arctic lights, or how they're called, auroras. That's the ionosphere interacting with solar wind, as we call it, so or storms from the sun. And those electrons, they can fly around, they can have effect on nitrogen. But what we see this year in terms of ozone hole has actually been predicted quite accurately simply by including the effect of the Hanga Tonga volcano, which we discussed before. And the reason there is that more water vapor in the stratosphere means also more ozone destruction. And that's due to how the ozone chemistry works. And so for this year's ozone hole, we have actually expected this to become very big this year because of that volcano. And that is enough of an explanation for why this ozone hole is so big. So, and then the ozone hole has a really minor effect on global temperatures, in particular in the northern hemisphere where we had the heat wave. The ozone hole is over the South Pole. The heat waves were in the northern hemisphere summer, far on the other side of the globe, basically. So I don't think we should link that solar activity to current warm global temperatures and the heat waves the northern hemisphere has experienced.
Okay, well, we've tried to cover a lot here. Martin, what are you working on next?
Next, I am working on trying to find out how storms, not thunderstorms, but large storms which bring flooding, how they will, might change, if at all, in the future, in order to try and be prepared for possibly more extensive flooding, in particular in Australia.
That's a big question, and here we're seeing all these floods in Turkey and Greece and Bulgaria and in South America. We saw them in China earlier this year, Japan. So it's definitely becoming a global phenomenon. We'll look forward to that research. From the Climate Change Research Center at the University of New South Wales, we've been speaking with Dr. Martin Eucher. You can find links to the science we just talked about in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Martin, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
This year of 2023 has been a revelation for all of us, scientists included. Just as we thought to comprehend how the world works, surprises jolt our understanding. Why did Earth rapidly lose its solar shield in the Antarctic sea ice? Why did we take such a sharp jump in temperatures, not just in the northern hemisphere in the summer, but in the southern winter as well? Why the big storms that are flooding city streets across the globe? Why is it starting to rain in Antarctica? Why is the great conveyor belt of ocean currents weakening? These things have experts guessing, testing new theories they are applying for grant money to find out. The rest of us are just reeling from repeated blows of record extreme weather. Some scientists, like Michael Mann at Penn State, suggest we do know why. The cause is global warming, built up from decades of fossil-powered emissions and deforestation. Others calculated all that and never came up with the extreme changes in events seen this year. They try to add a little for solar activity, a bit for ship pollution cuts, maybe extra methane from bogs and beaver ponds. Even all that doesn't give you record-smashing heat waves around the world, instant Cat 5 hurricanes, and destabilized glaciers in such a short period of time. All the best models and minds did not predict this, and now things are shifting so rapidly, maybe we can't predict what comes next. The prediction system is broken, and that could be as dangerous as the threat of nuclear war. We failed to plan for the known. Now we can hardly plan for the unknown, except maybe to duck down into a minimum footprint with a fallback position and manual backups for everything. What is pushing us into a dangerous new state so fast? We do not know, and we may not find out in time. As Naomi Klein would say, this changes everything. But there is still the joy of trying to discover all the amazing things on this planet and in this universe. For example, we heard Martin Eucher was trained in plasma physics. It blows my mind trying to understand plasma. I had to look it up again. We learned there's a fourth state of matter beyond solid, liquid, and gas. Plasma is 99.9% of visible matter in this universe, and the public knows practically nothing about it. Of course, we seldom experience it. The precession of matter is the story of heat, with heat being the energy or motion within the molecules and atoms. The lowest form of energy, almost frozen in space and time, are the solids from rocks to tree bark. Most solids, if you heat them enough, go into a liquid state. We see that when ice melts, but rocks too become liquid with the heat of volcanoes. Add a lot more heat to those liquids, and they dissipate into a gas form. Even metals can have a gas state. Their molecules and atoms float in the atmosphere. That is about as far up the ladder of heat humans can ever experience. But with enormous amounts of heat or energy, like the atomic fusion on our sun, atoms break up. Electrons can break free of the nucleus to form a kind of fog of particles. That is plasma. But these hard planets are lonely exceptions in a universe mostly containing fields of plasma mixed with cold space. There is hardly anything solid out there. Our situation on a rock in this solar system racing through space is extremely rare and perhaps unique. That is another reason why we should honor it and learn to live in harmony with all other life on our planetary home. With Wonder for the Universe, I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
And now, some swing music from the previous century. Let's count Basie swing at the Woodside. Coming up next, Charlie Barnett, Skyliner, Duke Ellington, Perdido, and Fats Waller.
Yeah. mountain. It's a sin to tell a lie. Millions of hearts have been broken, yes, yes. Just because these words were spoken. You know the words that were spoken? Here it is. I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Yes, but if you break my heart, I'll break your jaw and then I'll die. Don't be sure it's true when you say I love you. It's a sin to tell a lie. Now get on out there and tell your lie. What is it?
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Environmental Impacts of Large Dams and Reservoirs, Updated Archive. This is the second part of an archival program on the epic struggle over dams, displaced people, and the environment, recorded by me for TUC Radio in 2006. Today you will hear from Patrick McCauley. He was then the executive director of the International Rivers Network. They are supporting communities around the world that are impacted by destructive dams. On their 2023 website, internationalriversnetwork.org, list 217 dam projects around the world that they have helped delay or stop. Globally, the building of mega dam projects is slowing down, but the world is left with dams and reservoirs that are decaying and are now becoming a danger to people downstream. Just this morning, as I'm preparing this program for distribution, terrible news is coming in from Libya. Cyclone Daniel hit eastern Libya yesterday, and floods from heavy rains overtopped the reservoirs of two dams south of the city of Derna. Both dams were destroyed, and the flood swept entire neighborhoods with people, houses, and bridges into the ocean. Here's a clip from Sky News from September 12, 2023.
The Mediterranean storm Daniel has hit Libya hard and fast, and thousands are feared to be missing as flash floods rip through eastern towns, erasing entire neighborhoods. A spokesman for the country's eastern armed forces attributed the catastrophic floods to the collapse of two nearby dams.
Dams collapsed in the south of Derna. The first and second dams on Wadi Derna caused water to flow into Wadi Derna inside the city. Three bridges collapsed completely, and water spread inside the neighborhoods, and there are entire neighborhoods that moved into the sea, including their residents.
Yusra Bagir,
Sky News.
That's the city of Derna in Libya. And now back to TUC Radio's archival interview that I did with Patrick McCauley. He worked so hard to prevent such disasters. The epic struggle over dams, displaced people, and the environment. A battle is being fought by independent scientists and those employed by the hydropower industry over the discovery that reservoirs behind the world's dams are a source of global warming pollution. In the case of big reservoirs in the tropics, where most new dams are proposed, hydropower can actually emit more greenhouse gases per kilowatt hour than fossil fuels, including dirty coal. The worst example studied by an independent scientist is the Balbina Dam in the Brazilian Amazon. The dam had a climate impact in 1990 equal to an astonishing 54 natural gas plants, generating the same amount of power. The issue of hydropower is important to all, as we are searching for the best replacement for fossil-fueled energy. Patrick McCauley is the author of Silenced Rivers, The Ecology and Politics of Large Dams. I interviewed him right after his return from the November 2006 United Nations negotiations on global climate in Nairobi. Here is Patrick McCauley.
The global warming impact of dams is definitely one of the least known impacts of dams upon the global systems. The general message that the dam industry puts out is that hydropower is clean and renewable and climate friendly, and that compared to dirty coal or other fossil fuels, this is a much better way of generating our energy. But actually, there's a number of reasons for opposing this depiction of hydropower. And global warming is just one of them. The impacts of the huge numbers of people that are displaced, you know, 40 to 60 million people worldwide have been displaced by dams, not just hydropower, but dams, but for all purposes. 60% or so of the world's rivers have been damaged to some extent by the impoundments of reservoirs and the changes in river flows that dams caused. You've seen huge loss of riverine species. Fish is the best known, but also all other types of life forms that live in rivers and life forms that even live in floodplains, sometimes quite far from the river, but they're impacted by the loss of the normal floods that dams cause. So there's a huge range of impacts, which means that dams are often a very dirty technology. There's also the issue of sedimentation. Dams fill with sediment over time. All rivers carry some amount of sediments, and almost all dams will eventually fill up with sediments and become nothing more than very expensive waterfalls. So from that respect, this is not a renewable energy the way, say, solar or wind power is. But on the global warming emission, in the tropics where most of the new dams are being built, the emissions of greenhouse gases, methane and carbon dioxide, also nitrous oxide, can be extremely high. And in many cases, it appears as high or in some cases even much higher than fossil fuel power.
That's a surprise to people that, after all these sacrifices of land and lives, that you don't even come up with a technology that's beneficial. You actually pointed to this issue in your book already. You have a little chapter. You were one of the first people to describe the greenhouse gas emissions of dams. Can you explain the science behind it?
Yeah, well, first, as I say, yes, it's not new that to discover that dams do emit greenhouse gases. It's been known since the mid-90s and quantified to some extent since the mid-90s, but it's been a very little-known branch of science, and there hasn't been very many scientists working on it, and most of the scientists who have been working on it are funded by the hydropower industry, so, of course, there's been an interest to really downplay the significance of the emissions. But over the years, there has been more studies have come out, and it has become clear just how serious the emissions are. And it still is a very complex issue, and there are a lot of uncertainties. But there's enough known now, anyway, to say that these emissions are very high. And how does it happen? Well, when you flood a large area of land in the tropics, you're flooding a lot of carbon. You flood all the forests. There's carbon in the soils. All the the vegetation that was there before the reservoir. And when that rots, it gives off the gas, or creates the gas, carbon dioxide underwater, also creates methane, which is actually a much more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, around over 20 times more effective at trapping heat than carbon dioxide. Now, when the studies were first done on this issue, it was thought, okay, there are emissions from the flooding of the forest vegetation that was flooded, but after, say, 10 years when all that vegetation is flooded, then it will be clean, it will be climate friendly, there will be no more emissions. Turns out that's not the case. Now, studies have been done in reservoirs that are several decades old, and they find still very high emissions. And the reason for that is that not only do you have the carbon in the vegetation originally flooded, but also you have carbon which flows down the river. Every river carries carbon in various forms, mainly the organic matter, the leaves and different parts of vegetation that fall into the river, and carbon from the soils that's washed into the river as part of erosion. That all enters the reservoir, and then that provides the fuel to keep the greenhouse gas emissions going. You have also plants that grow in the reservoir. You have plankton and water weeds that grow on the surface of the reservoir. All the different life forms in the reservoir, they die, sink to the bottom, and provide more fuel for the emissions. You have plants that grow around the edge of the reservoir. So when the reservoir is lower during the dry season, you get a lot of, if it's a sort of a shallow type of reservoir in a largely flat area, you get a lot of plants go around the edge, and then the reservoir is filled again. Those plants are flooded, and then they rot and give off, especially methane is the one that's especially problematic. So basically, for the lifetime of the reservoir, it seems that you do have these emissions. And where you have a large reservoir and a not particularly high generating capacity, then you will have emissions that are at least on the same scale as fossil fuels, if not worse. And some of the cases in Brazil are quite stunning. One of the dams in the central Amazon called Balbina, which flooded a large, very flat area for a pretty small amount of electricity, its emissions are something like 54 times those of a gas plant, a modern, very efficient gas plant, which is shockingly high. It's about almost 30 times that of a dirty coal plant. So these can be incredibly high emissions. And saying that, of course, you can get a hydropower plant in a canyon, a very narrow canyon, doesn't flood a lot of vegetation, and has a high generating capacity. And there the emissions won't be significant and won't be anything like a fossil fuel plant. But basically, like the Amazon, most of the reservoirs are actually in rather flat land, so they do have very high emissions.
I guess people are really beginning to see that these reservoirs are not like normal lakes. They have sort of a curious...
Well, there's a number of reasons why they're not like lakes. Now, one thing that's important to remember is that lakes themselves are quite high emitters of methane and carbon dioxide, so that the average emissions for each square meter of lake is much higher than the average emissions from each square meter of land. So even if a reservoir was just like a lake, you still would increase greenhouse gas emissions. But for a number of reasons, reservoirs are different. And one thing that happens with hydropower is that you have a dam, and obviously water exits the dam. It either goes through the turbines to generate electricity, or certain times of the year when basically there's too much water for the turbines, it goes over through a spillway and travels downstream that way. Now, what happens is that with the reservoir water in the tropics, it's very rich in methane, and that methane is under pressure because, of course, the deeper you go in the water, the higher the pressure is on the methane. But then the water from some depth, the actual depth will vary according to the individual dam. The water at depth will be released through the turbines or through the spillway. The pressure is released, and then suddenly you have this huge fizz of methane and carbon dioxide bubbles, and it's analogous to opening a bottle of soda, a bottle of Coke, or whatever soft drink you like, and just like a bottle of Coke, you open it, or especially if you shake it, you get a more dramatic effect. The carbon dioxide fizzes up because the pressure is released, and that's just the same thing is happening at a dam. And those emissions at the dam itself can be very sizable. Now, when I first wrote about this issue back in 95 or so, I was unaware, scientists were unaware of this impact, but in the last 10 years it's been increasingly studied, and it's been very controversial because if you include the what are called degassing emissions or operational emissions at the dam itself, you increase greatly, and in some cases you increase by several times your measurement of the overall climate impact of the dam. So the hydropower industry has been very emphatic in saying, no, these degassing emissions don't exist, or if they do exist, they're very small, and you can't just use, you know, mathematical models and do science to predict what these emissions are going to be. You can only count the emissions from the surface of the reservoir, but scientifically, it doesn't seem to have any basis to not count the degassing emissions, and I get the feeling the hydropower industry is realizing that actually they can't sort of hold out against this anymore, and they're going to have to include these emissions. Very recently, so since I came out with our latest report on this issue, there's been more studies showing that there's also degassing emissions downstream, so not all the methane is released at the dam itself. And the people who are modeling the emissions at the dam are not presuming that all is released. They're saying something like 60% of the methane is actually released at the dam. But now people have been studying the river downstream and saying a lot of that remaining 60% is released downstream. So when you include that, it means the impact of the reservoir is even higher.
Downstream, releases downstream. How does that happen?
So you have the very methane-rich water, which is expelled from the dam, and then a lot of the methane, say 60%, depending on the design of the spillway and other factors, is released at the dam itself, but it's still, the water is still very rich in methane when it exits the dam. So over the several kilometers, I think studies have been done for 10 kilometers downstream of the dam, you still have a lot of methane being emitted from the water, and something like a third as much methane, or up to a third as much methane from the river immediately downstream as from the whole surface of the reservoir itself. Petit Saut Dam in French Guiana, this was the first place where they measured the degassing emissions at the dam itself, and first time they realized how high these could be. The methane emissions at Petit Saut are huge. Overall, the average impact over the first 20 years of its operation is about five times higher than those from what a gas plant would be. Originally, when the dam was built, the emissions weren't so high, but then the water was very high levels of dissolved methane in it, and it was poisonous to all aquatic life. So for about 80 kilometers downstream, basically everything was killed. And so they then had to build a little weir, a small dam, immediately downstream of the main dam to create a little waterfall and then basically oxygenate the water. But in that process, they also gave off a lot more of the methane. So they enabled the river not to be totally toxic to life downstream, but then greatly increased the greenhouse gas emissions. In Brazil, there's been one a rigorously independent scientist called Philip Fernside, who's an American but has spent 30 years in Brazil working in the Amazon, and he's one of the world's leading experts on the science of carbon dioxide fluxes, emissions, and the sinks for carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the forests of the Amazon. So he has done a number of studies on reservoirs and showing that the emissions are very high. He's been vociferously, quite brutally, you could say, attacked by the hydropower lobby-funded scientists in Brazil. But just in the last year or two, sort of some more scientists are starting to look at this issue and really come to the defense of Philip Fernside and say, look, these attacks on him are ridiculous, and this is just basic science that he's doing. So the journal Climatic Change, which is a very respected journal on this issue the climate change issue in general, did an editorial written by two analysts from Stanford saying, you know, this is a ridiculous way to carry out scientific study, and that basically Fernside appears to be right in what he's saying. His assumptions all make sense, and that this issue has become too politicized to really to get some serious science out of it, so we need some independent review to sort of neutralize the power of the hydro lobby in the science, and that's what we've been pushing for in terms of trying to get the United Nations to get their scientific bodies that work on climate change to look at this issue, and the results are going to be that it will become generally accepted that the tropical hydropower emissions can be very high.
You know, seen in the context of the enormously rising carbon dioxide emissions, we do need to come up with an explanation, an honest explanation, where it all comes from, not just from the tailpipes of automobiles or industrial emissions.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the many reasons why climate change is so incredibly difficult for us to get a grip with and to really try to reduce is there are so many different sources of greenhouse gases. The ones from tailpipes of cars and smokestacks of power plants are the most obvious ones, but there's also huge emissions which come just from land change, from farmers plowing fields, and the type of plowing method you use will affect how much carbon you release. There's huge releases from natural ecosystems, which are very poorly understood, wetlands and different types of forests. There's different gases we're talking about. There's carbon dioxide is the best known, and then there's methane, and then there's nitrous oxide, which is it's released in much smaller quantities than the other gases, but it's very powerful, 200 times more than carbon dioxide, more or less. And then you have some industrial gases, the HFC, HCFC gases, for example. These were all alternatives to the infamous CFCs, which are destroying the ozone layer. But unfortunately, the CFC alternatives are themselves very powerful greenhouse gases, some of them almost 12,000 times more powerful than carbon dioxide. So to deal with this problem, we need to know all the very many different sources of the gases and then work out what's the best way of controlling them all, and try to work out also, you know, which is the most cost-effective way to go and which ones can we start to reduce the quickest. I mean, it's very easy to measure, relatively easy to measure the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we've been doing it since the 50s. And every year you can get a very accurate scientific, I mean, any day you can get a very accurate scientific measurement of what that concentration is, but it's much more difficult to actually work out where is all that carbon dioxide coming from. And the figures that are available show that I would say maybe something like 10% of all the global methane emissions could be coming from reservoirs. Some people say it's much higher. If we were to include reservoirs in global inventories of methane emissions, and currently they're not included at all, that it would almost double our estimates of methane emissions. But whatever it is a very sizable component of the total emissions, and something that we need to, at the very least, we need to stop increasing this area of large reservoirs and stop making this problem worse.
Yeah, listening to you, it seems that even if a dam were to be retired as electricity producing, just sitting there, a dam and a reservoir would still have climate impact.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point. What does happen towards the end of a dam's life if it becomes too filled up with sediment to generate power anymore and it's, you know, turned off, which has happened to quite a few dams around the world. If the dam is kept in place, then you will have a big wetland behind the dam, and it is likely to have very high greenhouse gas emissions, pretty much in perpetuity. Now, you do have the issue that you could decommission the dam, and increasingly this is becoming seen as a viable option, actually removing the dam. Problem is, for the very big projects, that would be hugely expensive, and the way hydropower plant financing currently works, no money is set aside for the eventual decommissioning of the plant. There should be a certain percentage of money each year the dam generates electricity, a certain percentage of money should be put aside so to allow for eventual decommissioning. It's not done, so a lot of countries are going to end up in 50, 100 years' time with huge numbers of dams that they built all over their rivers, and they're going to be filled with sediment. They're not going to be very much use. They're going to be very dangerous and pose threats to people living downstream, and there's not going to be any money to remove them, so this is a future threat we face.
Talk a little bit more about the simple scale of these projects that you described so beautifully in your book.
Well, hydropower projects, dam projects in general, are some of the biggest constructions that human beings create, and the dams themselves are some of the largest pieces of physical infrastructure that we've ever built, and reservoirs are, as human artifacts, are on the scale of our largest cities. People talk about the Great Wall of China as being the only human artifact you can see from space. I've actually heard that's not true. You can't see it, but you can see reservoirs from space. If you look at a map of the world, you'll see quite a lot of reservoirs around the world that show up even on the scale of a map. For some countries, large percentages of their total area are flooded under reservoirs. For Ghana in West Africa, that has the world's largest reservoir, 5% of the area of the country is flooded by one reservoir. And globally, the area of reservoirs is, there's various estimates, range between 260,000 square kilometers up to 1.5 million square kilometers, a huge range there. This is on the scale of the state of California, I think is around 400,000 square kilometers. So you're talking something like the entire land area of California being flooded by reservoirs worldwide, which is a huge loss of land at something like around between 0.5 to 1% of the world's the sort of terrestrial surface of the Earth that is flooded. But it's important to remember that what we're talking about is not just any 1% of the Earth's surface. This is river valley land. This is some of the best land we have in terms of agriculturally productive land, in terms of biologically productive wetlands and riverside forests and so on. So we're losing some of the most diverse and most productive land that we have.
The shocking thing is that the hydropower generated often does not go to the people around it or the displaced people. It goes directly into a smelter.
Yeah, it goes to aluminum smelters, or it goes to the cities, or it goes to mines. No, you see it, especially places like Africa, sometimes the most shocking, where you have some of the world's biggest hydro plants, and yet you have very low rates of people with access to electricity. You know, Uganda, where we've been doing a lot of work recently, 95% of the population doesn't have access to electricity. I mean, I've been to villages that have been displaced by dams, and the power lines almost literally go right overhead. I mean, you see the power lines just, you know, over the next hillside, and the village, meanwhile, has no electricity, and, you know, probably will never get electricity, or at least will never get electricity from the dam. Maybe they will be able to have some small-scale solar panels or something, but even a micro-hydro that might provide village-level benefits. But these big projects, the power lines, they go off to the cities.
Some people will claim that the hydro projects also opened up lands for irrigation that were previously not used.
They do. Reservoirs have opened up a lot of land for irrigation, but there's a number of problems with this. One thing is the belief that land that wasn't irrigated before was not used, and very often you have land which actually is used by people but not using irrigation, or sometimes they are using irrigation, but maybe irrigating crops once a year as opposed to twice a year. But very often what we see is that you have small-scale farmers using lands which are then taken over by large commercial agribusiness when the water comes in. You can see the impact of this in California, where huge amounts of land have been irrigated through the Central Valley of California, through the big dam and canal schemes, the big aqueducts we've built. And you look at the counties in California with the very lowest social indicators in terms of highest poverty levels, lowest income levels and so on, you see those are the counties which get the most irrigation water, because irrigation water tends to mean big, very capital-intensive farms where laborers are working for very low wages, and you don't have basically small family farms don't survive in those areas. And the same thing happens in the rest of the world, but the additional problem in many places is that these big schemes are incredibly poorly managed, and you have lots of leaks of water from the canals, and you have a lot of water logging and salinization of the land, and you also have very poor yields. So you see yields on land which is irrigated from groundwater, from wells, is often 2 to 3 times higher than the yields from the big dam and canal schemes. And you hear a lot of arguments made by the dam industry now that, you know, with this growing population, we need to feed the growing population, therefore we're going to need to build lots more of these big dam and canal projects and irrigate more land. But you actually look at the world and where the places are we have left to build these projects, there's very few. To build a big dam and canal project, you need a large expanse of flat land near a major river, and most of those places are now exploited. I mean, take California, for example. Central Valley in California is pretty much fully exploited now. There's nowhere for agriculture to expand. In fact, agriculture is retreating because of suburban sprawl. And it's the same whether you look in India and Africa, South America. There's very few large areas left for this type of irrigation. On the other hand, there's huge parts of the world, rural parts of the world, which have been starved of any type of government investment, because all the investment has been thrown into these big irrigation schemes. And if you are serious about wanting to reduce poverty worldwide, if you're serious about wanting to increase food production, serious about trying to meet these United Nations Millennium Development Goals, which are all about reducing poverty and improving the lives of the poorest people, that's only going to be done through a program of small-scale water infrastructure, small dams and rainwater harvesting schemes, and better use of groundwater and small technologies like treadle human-operated pumps, and technologies which are cheap and small-scale, can be used locally, don't depend on billions of dollars of foreign capital coming in and building huge schemes, which are then going to grow crops which are largely for export anyway and don't feed local people. So if we had a very different model of agricultural and water development, we could make really huge strides in dealing with the the worst problems of poverty in the world. If we continue in this model of pouring all our money into these big projects, we're going to see very little returns out of it.
You heard my November 2006 interview with Patrick McCauley on the environmental impacts of large dams and reservoirs. He was then executive director at International Rivers Network. He also was a co-editor of The Ecologist magazine in England, and he's the author of Silenced Rivers: The Ecology and Politics of Large Dams. Patrick McCauley joined Reclaim Finance in 2021 as Energy Transition Senior Analyst. They say that the new tools of green finance have not had a positive impact in the transition to fossil fuel-free energy and propose alternatives. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.